Good morning, Great Oaks. How are we doing? Yeah, it's so good to see all of you. If I haven't introduced myself to you, my name is Daniel Williams. I am the student pastor here at Great Oaks. So I get to actually spend time with most of the people that are on stage this morning. And so they're doing an incredible job. Through this series, we are actually in our last week of the book of James. And if you haven't been with us, kind of the main idea through the book of James is we've been looking at the practical topics that James gives us as they are addressed with the overall idea of when our faith is being tested. If you haven't been with us, we've talked about topics like, what does it mean to find joy in the midst of our trials? What does it mean to not only be hearers of the word, but doers of the word? How our words matter, not only that they can build up, but they can also tear down. We've talked about what it means to have a kingdom mindset, how also God meets us with grace in the midst of our pride. And last week, Pastor Chase talked about wealth, how wealth is not the sin, but our desire and our pursuit for it is. As we jump into our final chapter of James and our final topic and passage, James is going to address the idea and the topic of waiting. I know we all love waiting, don't we? Well, so much so that I'm going to make you wait a little bit more, and I'm going to pray for us real quick, okay? So let me pray. Lord, I'm so thankful for this morning. Thankful for every person that's in this room. I'm thankful for how you've prepared the way for us this morning and what you want to speak to us. God, may we receive what you have for us this morning from the book of James. God, may you take center stage and totally just remove me from it. Speak to us individually and directly. May we leave this place changed. Amen. So I know that I just introduced myself to some of you for the first time, but can I just confess something to you? I hate waiting. And I know that whether you're in this room or you're online, you probably hate waiting too. I hate waiting for things such as stoplights. Many of you who know me know that I always run behind. I tend to run late. I'm always in a rush. And we all know that that's when stoplights don't work like they're supposed to, right? Like, turn green! I need you to turn green, right? And they just always stay red. I hate waiting at the grocery store, especially during Black Friday or Thanksgiving or other holidays, right? You go to the store and it's like, oh my gosh, I gotta wait in this line. And half the time, you have one item or two and you're like, I'm just trying to get out of here, right? And self-checkout doesn't work. And so then you're looking at everything and you're like, oh, what's the shortest line so I don't have to wait as long? I hate waiting for commercials, especially the ones that don't give you that skip button in the bottom right corner and you have to watch the entirety of the commercial like it's 2005 all over again, right? I was alive for that. I hate waiting in lines at the amusement park for 3 hours to ride a ride that may take 2 minutes. Disney fans, anyone? I hate waiting. What's that thing that you hate waiting for? And I'm not any longer talking about the easy things or the everyday. I'm talking about that thing that drives your anxiety, your worry, the thing that keeps you up at night or makes you restless. What do you hate waiting for? One of the hardest periods of waiting in my life was when I was waiting for my relationship with my stepdad to be reconciled. And many of you who don't know my story, I don't know my biological dad. I've never met him. What I do know of him is I know his name and I know what he looks like, okay? And so in the midst of that, maybe you guys can relate to this. Some of you can. And growing up maybe with a house that's not what feels to be complete. And as a kid, what I struggled with is I would look at other families and I would see how the kids had both parents. And I wondered so often, what am I missing out on? Like, it would be so awesome to have that father figure who would teach me how to be a man, to encourage me and build me up, to take me on trips and make all of these amazing memories and things that when we're older we can look back on and say, man, I loved that moment. A person who may build a four-wheeler or a go-kart, or maybe my first car. That encourager who would be my sports coach. I didn't have that. I missed out on all of those things. Thankfully, the Lord has given me an incredible mom, and many of you have met her. She's an absolute gift from heaven. She's a little wild, but she's awesome, okay? And that was totally on purpose, and God gave me exactly what I needed. But what I want you to know is I still wrestled with those things. And even today, I still wrestle with what I potentially missed out on. When I was 8 years old, my mom married my stepdad. And it was in this moment that I looked at my stepdad, and I'm like, you're going to bridge the gap. You're going to be that person that meets all the expectations and all the needs that I never had met. It's the time where we can begin to create those memories and those things that I truly longed for. And what I can tell you is while we had some decent moments and decent memories, my relationship with my stepdad was never great. In fact, it wasn't really ever good. The person that I hoped would be my encourager was often my biggest critic. The person that I believed in my heart of hearts that if I just made him proud, everything would be okay, and oftentimes it was met with disappointment. I remember when I was 20 and I moved from Ohio to Illinois, and my parents decided to get a divorce. And so if you are aware of divorce, if you unfortunately have walked through a divorce or have seen divorce from afar, you know that if kids are involved, oftentimes the goal is not to have them involved in it, but they're always put in the middle. So even from afar, even as an adult, I watched my mom get drugged through the mud. I didn't love what happened and the decisions that were being made and how she was treated in the midst of those things. That led me to put in some pretty severe but healthy boundaries, which meant I may never see or talk to my stepdad ever again. I remember a couple months after their divorce was final and I had put these boundaries in place. I hadn't seen him. I hadn't talked to him. And of all places, one morning I got in the shower and the Lord had spoken and said, I want you to just pray for him. Just pray for your stepdad. I didn't know why. I didn't know what was to come of that. I didn't know what to expect and what God was going to do. But what I can tell you is I stepped into a period of waiting. Waiting. What is that thing that you're waiting for? I think if we're honest, all of us in this room are waiting for something. Maybe you're waiting for that day when your relationship with your kids gets better and it's beautiful and yet there's so much tension. Maybe you're waiting for that day when you get that promotion at your job and still it just continues to go elsewhere and it doesn't come your way. Maybe you're waiting for that day when you get married. When you have a significant other that comes into your life because you just feel alone. Maybe you're waiting for that day when your smile is actually genuine and your mental health battles are no more. That day, that prayer that you've been praying and praying on repeat is answered, but you feel like God has just hung up the phone. That day when you don't fall back into that addiction or that habit. It's not the thing that you run to anymore. This idea of waiting. This morning, as we dive into our text, into this passage, James is going to address the idea of waiting. And the question that I want us to ask ourselves then is, how do we wait well? How do we wait well? So if you have a Bible, or it'll also be on the screen, you can follow along with me. We're going to be in James chapter 5, verses 7 through 12. It says this. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it. Until it receives the early and late rains, you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door as an example of suffering and patience, brothers. Take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard the steadfastness of Job, how you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. How do we wait well? Well, James begins this passage by shifting our focus to a reoccurring topic and idea and theme that is woven throughout the entirety of the book of James. It's the idea of suffering. More specifically, how we respond to suffering. If you were with us or have read the beginning chapter of the book of James, he begins the first three verses like this. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. He takes another opportunity to address this idea of how we respond to suffering, because the point that he ultimately wants to make this morning is that waiting well is paramount when our faith is under fire. Waiting well is paramount when our faith is under fire. He begins to frame this statement from the very beginning. Look at verses 7 and 8 again. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. James, as he focuses on how we wait well when our faith is under fire, begins with using a phrase and repeating it with intentionality. Be patient. Be patient in your waiting. Be patient in your suffering. Be patient. He then uses an illustration that historically would make sense to his audience, but is also pretty common throughout Scripture. Why? Because in their day, in their culture, they were heavily agricultural. They would understand the role and the life and the work of a farmer. And what he points out is kind of the role of the farmer is a little bit different than what we would picture. If you're connected to farming, if you kind of know the life of farming, you may get this a little bit more than some of us else in this room. But here's kind of the life of a farmer in this day. They would plant their seeds for crops. They would pray for rain, and then they would wait. What's ironic about this is that in their waiting, there's so many different things that could go wrong that were totally out of their control. They couldn't speed up the process. They couldn't run ahead and make it happen. For example, too much rain would rot your crops. Too much sun would burn your crops. And if you were unlucky like us to have an early freeze, your crops would be eliminated. The farmer. And he says, we have to learn to wait well. And here's what I want to think about the farmer, is this is their livelihood. This is what puts food on their table. This is what protects and continues to provide for their family. You guys would feel this in your job. I go to work because this is my livelihood. I go to work because I want to put food on the table. Now imagine if most of your role was to wait and all of the things that could happen were out of your control. James is encouraging us to wait well. And so how do we wait well? There's going to be three things that we discuss this morning. And the first one that James talks about is we wait well when we wait with patience. We wait well when we wait with patience. Now the Greek word for this text for patience is pronounced makrothameo, which is not the same as what we would define patience or view patience as. It means to have long suffering, to have perseverance. To make it more applicable and understanding for us, is this means to have a long temper. Now, in comparison, we know what it means to have a short temper, don't we? Maybe you know that person. Hopefully, you're not nudging your neighbor or looking at yourself in your reflection on your phone. But we know what it means to have a short temper, don't we? When things go wrong, it sets me off. I lose control. I spout out at the mouth. I have no control over my emotions or my words, and it knocks me off balance. Makrothameo means long-tempered. Which means when things go wrong, things out of my control, when things get rigid or tough, I can still stay firmly fitted. I don't lose control. I can remain calm. That means I can be patient when the relational breakdown happens. I can be patient when the debt continues to pile up. I can be patient when my relationship with my kids is not great. When the promotion goes a different direction. Patience. And here's the thing. I don't know really what we're waiting for. I can't define all of that for you guys, but what I know is that waiting is hard. Telling you to be patient is hard. It's hard to receive that, but this idea of patience, we wait well when we wait with patience. James then makes his second point by saying how we wait well, and he says, we wait well when we wait united with hope. He actually looks back at his first point when he talks about this idea of patience, and he actually answers the question of, why do we wait patient? And he says there's two reasons. We see this in verses 8 and 9. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. We wait well when we wait united with hope. There's two reasons why James addresses this and why we should be patient. The first is this, because the coming of the Lord is at hand. Now, granted, this was written over 2,000 years ago, right? And we're looking at this and we're like, when's it happening? Right? And this is a pretty hot topic, isn't it? Like, oh my gosh, the stars are aligning. The book of Revelation, look at all the things that are happening. The end times are here, right? And we're spending all of our time in preparation. For many of us, we grow tired of waiting because it hasn't happened yet. Like, man, how can I cling to hope in the midst of this? Because this was written over 2,000 years ago and it still hasn't happened. Why is he taking his time? Here's what I want to remind us. That in comparison to eternity, such a short time. Such a short time. I want you to think once more with me about the farmer. Because I can look at their work, I can look at the role, I can look at the everyday, and the question that I have for them is, why do you wait? Like, what? Why do you wait when everything that's out of your control can happen and it can totally wreck your family and totally wreck your income? James would say it's because the fruit is precious. In other words, the harvest is worth it. And I don't know what you're waiting on. I don't know what keeps you up at night or keeps you restless, but here's what I know, is that we're all waiting for the same day. It's that day pictured in Revelation 21, verse 4, when he will wipe away every tear from our eyes, when there will be no more mourning or more sorrow or pain or crying, and that everything of the old age is gone. In other words, we're waiting to be with Jesus forever. That's what our heart's desire is. That's what we truly long for. And I think oftentimes we look at this and we're like, well, he hasn't come back yet, and I'm dealing with all of these things that I'm waiting for. But here's the thing. How precious is that? How precious is it to be in eternity with Jesus in comparison to any other harvest? Precious. It's worth the wait. Here's what I can promise you. You may have lost hope in the thing you're waiting on right now, but nothing that you're waiting for, nothing that you're going through, nothing that you've already walked through compares to the glory that comes with eternity with Jesus. Chase talked about this last week when he talked about the idea of discontentment, that at some level we have discontentment because what we truly want and truly long for can't be achieved here on planet Earth. Is what we truly desire to be with our Creator, to be with our Savior, eternity forever. The second reason why he addresses this is why we should be patient is so we don't turn on each other. I think if I were to take a poll and we were to have a conversation, I think we would all agree that the world seems more divided than ever, doesn't it? Racially, we're divided. Politically, we're divided. Churches are divided. Families are divided. Marriages are divided. And we can say that it's just the conditions of the world and the conditions of humanity, but really what it is we've given up hope in the waiting. And we've looked out at the world and we're like, well, if things would just change, if all we got to do is just behave differently or believe differently, then things would actually change. But what we've done is we've shifted our focus from Jesus and his coming, and we've kind of made a trade, trading personal preference for the hope of he who is to come. Look what verse 9 says. He says, "Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." Here's what this means. God sees our division. He stands at the door and he watches the division and the spirit of division that's among us. He sees the fights that we have. He sees the things that we say about our neighbor behind their back. He sees the battles that we prioritize over the battle for lost souls to come to know Jesus. And he's just like, "What are you guys doing? All of these things are not worth the division that's among you. Something has to change." And really what it is that we've looked out at the world and we've said, well, here's how this changes. It's not about behavior or ideas changing or belief change, but what it is if I take a judgment seat and I look out at the world and I say, "I cannot believe that you believe that. Cannot believe that you're doing that. Cannot believe that all of these things are happening and you're the biggest part of it." If we take a judgment seat, we believe it's going to change something. But the problem with that is that when we take the judgment seat is the same moment that we bought into the lie that God is too slow and we tried to run ahead. I love what 2 Peter 3:9 says. That the Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is faithful, patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but for everyone to come to repentance. But we buy into this lie that God is too slow and we grow impatient. Here's what I want you to know, that impatience with God often leads to impatience with God's people. And impatience with God's people leads to a divided kingdom. And a house that is divided cannot do what? Stand. We got to stop with the division. We got to learn to be patient. We're not waiting well if there's division among us. So how do we wait well? We wait with hope and unity. Lastly, he makes this third and final point on how to wait well. We find this in verses 11 and 12. He says, "Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation." So how do we wait well? First, we wait with patience. Second, we wait united with hope, or with hope and unity. And third, we wait faithfully with integrity. What's interesting about this is as James addresses this idea or this topic of waiting well with faithfully with integrity, he makes two points. The first point that he makes is he focuses in on a story in the Bible that so many of us want to avoid, because it's all about suffering. We don't like suffering. We avoid suffering. And what's ironic about what James is trying to say is that he uses this book of suffering as an encouragement, which is a little peculiar and ironic, because ultimately one of the reasons that a lot of people don't come to Jesus is the idea of suffering. Well, how could a good God allow this to happen? How could a loving God send someone to hell? How could God see all the things that are going on in the world and not just step in and stop it? Suffering. And he uses this as an encouragement, and I'm going to tell you why here in a few moments. But if you've never heard of the story or read through the story of Job, I just want to quickly summarize it for you. So God is in heaven, and the angels come, and they present themselves to God, and all of a sudden Satan the accuser comes, and him and God have a conversation. It's like, "What are you doing?" And Satan's like, "Well, I've been going back and forth on the earth, and no one loves you, God. Can't find one person." God's like, "Have you considered my servant Job? He's upright. He loves me." And Satan's like, "Well, no, it's because he's healthy, and it's because you've given him all these things. You've got a big family. The Bible tells us he has 7 children. He's got a wife. He's got the livestock. He's wealthy. He's considered one of the greatest humans in all of the East, and he's got that blue check mark. Great reputation." And Satan's like, "If I just took all that away, he wouldn't love you anymore. If I just made him suffer, he'd turn on you." So God's like, "Okay, You can test him, but I'm going to put parameters. You can't take his life. So Satan goes and he tests Job, and in a matter of what we believe to be hours, if not days, Job loses everything. All 7 children, all his livestock, all of his wealth, all of his property. He actually gets to keep his wife, but that's not a good thing. Sorry. He loses his friends. And it's in this moment that Job enters into a period of waiting. Not sure how God could show up, not sure what the breakthrough looks like, not sure if he would ever meet or see restoration or grace or mercy again. And the Bible tells us that instantly, at once, Job hits his knees, he shaves his head, he tears his clothes, and he worships God in the waiting. He says, "Naked from my mother's womb I've come, and naked I will depart. For the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." He praised in his pain. He worshiped while he waited. And then the kind of the process goes over again. Satan shows up. He's like, God's like, "Oh, well, you hear him singing? He didn't turn on me. He has a good heart. He loves me." And Satan tests him again, and he basically, what we see is that Job is sitting there writhing in pain, covered from head to toe in boils, scraping his skin with shards of clay. Then his wonderful wife comes. "Have you not turned on God? You should curse God and die." That person that's supposed to love you and encourage you and build you up and support you becomes the person that turns on you. He loses everything. The Bible tells us in Job 19 the culmination of his response and his waiting. Job 19, verses 25 through 28. "For I know that my Redeemer lives, that at the last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself. My eyes shall behold and not another, my heart faints within me." This is the moment when eternity matters the most. When all the material, all the sentimental, all the things that will ultimately fade are taken away. And what that does is everything is ripped away. It exposes who's actually on the throne of Job's heart. "All I long for is that day when I see him face to face. When all of this has faded away, when it's just us. No more pain. No more sorrow, no more mourning. I get to be in eternity with him forever." The end of the story is that Job gets restored times two. Now, we struggle with this a little bit because he doesn't get his kids back. He doesn't get the sentimental things back. But what he does get is a God that meets him with grace and mercy and restoration. And the reason that James uses this as an encouragement is because he knows the end of the story. That even in the midst of Job's waiting, there was something, a breakthrough on the other side. And here's why I use that to tell you guys this morning, is because I don't know what you're going through. I don't know what you're waiting on. I don't know what makes you believe that God is too slow. But here's what I know, is that we too know the end of the story. That we too have a Redeemer who lives, that one day we will see him face to face, that regardless of what we walk through in this life and in this world on this side of heaven, it's not going to compare to what's on the other side. We know too that our Redeemer lives. Lastly, he wraps up and finishes with a challenge. How do we live this out? We see this in verse 12. He says, "But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes, your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation." This follows a similar rhetoric of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5, verse 37, where he says, "Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Whatever is more than these is of the evil one." Here's what he's trying to say. As followers of Jesus, our character, our integrity, our words matter. Jesus and James would both tell us that all of these things, our yes and our no, should be trustworthy, that they should hold weight. I want to talk to 3 different people this morning. First, I want to talk to the entirety of the church, Great Oaks. What does it mean that our yes and our no hold weight, that they're trustworthy? If I were to ask you guys a question of how you came to church or how you came to know Jesus, I bet you with a resounding percentage that you would say that you got invited. Here's what that means. You trusted a Christian before you trusted Christ. And that's why it matters so much that when people look at us as the church, as followers of Jesus, that they see the same Jesus that meets them with grace and mercy and restoration, who is willing to come down from his throne in heaven to die a death that we so desperately still deserve to die. And he died in our place that we could have freedom and forgiveness and victory. Next, I want to talk to the person in here who hasn't made that decision to follow Jesus yet. Maybe you feel like life is in despair and you're just like, man, I just got so much stuff I'm waiting for. Maybe your yes this morning is to believe that God wants to meet you in that space. To meet you with grace and mercy and restoration. And your yes is to say yes to following Jesus for the first time. And lastly, those of you in the room who have said yes to Jesus already, maybe you're sitting here waiting and you're like, man, I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. Daniel, you don't know what I've been waiting for, but it's not happening. Maybe your yes, just say yes to continuing to be faithful with integrity. Continue to walk this out until the breakthrough comes, to worship in the midst of your waiting. Earlier, I told you a story about the hardest period of waiting for me in my life, waiting for my relationship with my stepdad to get reconciled, and I just want to tell you the end of that story. Now, keep in mind, my dad at this time was 75 years old. He didn't have GPS. He had never traveled from Ohio to Illinois to be at my house, and I hadn't talked to him or seen him. This is several months after I've been praying and praying and praying. And one morning, get a knock at the door. I go to the door, thought it was like junk mail or something. That's my dad standing there on my doorstep. Like, how do you explain that? Like, how didn't you end up in Iowa or somewhere? And he walks in and he sits down on the couch and he says, Daniel, I failed you. I didn't do good enough. I let you down. And I want to make it right. And here's why that matters. Because the waiting was awful. But the breakthrough was so worth it. To hear him say things I never thought he would say. To see him show up in my life in a way he never had before. In full circle, here's the breakthrough that in 3 weeks, less than 21 days, when I marry the love of my life. Yeah, there you go. He's going to be there. He's going to watch it happen. And if even that's the one promise that came true that he made to me, it's worth it. So how do we wait well? We wait with patience. We wait united with hope, and lastly, we wait faithfully with integrity. Here in a minute, we're going to jump into a new song. It's called Praise Before My Breakthrough. I love this song. And what it talks about is how we're going to worship in our waiting, how our praise becomes our triumph. And maybe for you this morning, what you came in with, you're like, man, I really just want to let it go. And so as we do this song, maybe it's your time, your invitation to just say yes. I trust you to let. I trust you to take what's in my hands and actually open your hands and trust him to take it. Maybe you came in here and you're like, I need prayer. Like, I need somebody to battle this with me. We have prayer people who love you and who are in your corner and who want to do that fighting with you, and they're on the side. But I would encourage you not to leave this place the same way you came in it. You guys can stand.